OA1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, officials across Europe have installed security devices made by Nuketech, a Chinese company with deep ties to China's government and military. Nuketech has quickly become the world's leading company for transport industry scanners and other security equipment. The company has not been permitted to do business in the U.S. for years because of national security concerns. But an Associated Press investigation found Nuketech is successful across Europe. The news group says the manufacturer's equipment is used in 26 of 27 EU member states. It is critical to operations at Europe's largest ports. Airports from Amsterdam to Athens also depend on Nuketech products, as do NATO's borders with Russia. But an increasing number of Western security officials are concerned that China could use Nuketech equipment in cyber warfare. They say China might interfere with Europe's transport system. The experts also warned of possible illegal Chinese access to secret government, industrial, and personal data through the company's connections. Bart Grothaus is a member of the European Parliament and former cybersecurity director at the Dutch Ministry of Defense. The data being processed by these devices is very sensitive, he said, noting that it included military information, personal information, and more. You want to make sure it's in right hands, he said. Grothaus and others say Europe does not have tools in place to resist such possible threats. Different member states have taken opposing views on Nuketech's security risks. No one has even been able to find out how many Nuketech devices have been installed across the continent. Nuketech rejects those concerns. It says Nuketech's European operations observe local laws, including strict security checks and data privacy rules. Robert Boos is deputy general manager of Nuketech in the Netherlands, where the company has a research and development center. He said, "It's our equipment, but it's your data. Our customer decides what happens with the data." He said Nuketech is a victim of unfounded claims that have cut its market share in Europe nearly in half since 2019. "In the 20 years we delivered this equipment, we never had issues of breaches or data leaks. Till today, we never had any proof of it," he added. China's national intelligence laws require Chinese companies to surrender data requested by state security agencies. Critics fear Nuketech would be unable to resist calls from China to release sensitive data about the shipments, people, and devices that pass through its scanners. They say there is a risk China could use Nuketech's presence across Europe to gather data about cross-border trade flows, pull information from local networks, or interfere with trade flows in a conflict. Axel Voss is a German member of the European Parliament who works on data protection. He said, "This is becoming more and more dangerous. I wouldn't mind if one or two airports had Nuketech systems, but with dumping prices, a lot of regions are taking it." Voss added, "This is becoming more and more a security question. You might think it's a strategic investment of the Chinese government." Nuketech's boss said the company keeps prices low by manufacturing in Europe. "We don't have to import goods from the U.S. or other countries," he said. "Our supply chain is very efficient with local suppliers. That's the main reason we can be very competitive." Nuketech is opening offices in Brussels, Madrid, and Rome. The company says it has supplied customers in more than 170 countries. Nuketech said in 2019 it had installed more than 1,000 security check devices in Europe for customs, air travel, ports, and government organizations.
The big French pet care company, Agrobioté Laboratoire, will no longer sell very small containers for raising fish. The company has a 27% share of the French market for products used by people who raise animals at home. But it said it would no longer sell any aquariums that hold less than 15 liters of water. They will only offer rectangular ones. The company said it was animal abuse to put fish in small bowls without added oxygen and filtration. Filtration is the process of removing small particles or waste from the water with a device. Agrobioté chief Mathieu Lambeau recently spoke to the Reuters news agency. He used the term impulse, meaning a sudden strong desire to do something, to describe why many adults buy goldfish. "People buy a goldfish for their kids on impulse," he said. Lambeau added, "But if they knew what a torture it is, they would not do it. Turning round and round in a small bowl drives fish crazy and kills them quickly. Goldfish can live up to 30 years and grow to about 25 centimeters in large aquariums or outdoor ponds. But in very small bowls, they often die within weeks or months." Lambeau said goldfish are social animals that need other fish, lots of space, and clean water. He added that having an aquarium requires some special equipment and knowledge. France is Europe's number one market for red aquarium fish, with about 2.3 million fish, Lambeau said. In earlier years, Agrobioté sold about 50,000 fish bowls per year at about 20 euros each. Germany and several other European countries have long banned fish bowls, but France has no laws on the issue. Lambeau believes the use of fish bowls to be an anachronism, something that seems to belong to the past. He explained the company's decision further by saying, "We cannot educate all our customers to explain that keeping fish in a bowl is cruel. We consider that it is our responsibility to no longer give consumers that choice." Lambeau suggested that the reality of fish bowls is sad. "There is demand for fish bowls," he said, "but the reality is that what we offer children is the possibility to see goldfish die slowly." I'm John Russell.
The American Space Agency, NASA, says its powerful James Webb Space Telescope has successfully reached its final position in orbit around the Sun. James Webb fired its rocket thrusters Monday for nearly 5 minutes to push the spacecraft into position about 1.6 million kilometers from Earth, NASA said in a statement. The agency describes James Webb as the largest and most powerful space science telescope ever built. It is meant to add to the discoveries of past telescopes while gathering more in-depth data on the early development of the universe. The orbiting observatory launched from French Guiana about a month ago. Its final position is known as the second Sun-Earth Lagrange point, or L2. This is a point where the gravitational forces of the Sun and Earth balance each other. This will permit the telescope to stay in line with Earth as it orbits the Sun. A large sun shield separates the telescope into hot and cold sides. One side will take in light and heat, the other will be shielded and remain cold. The side with the telescope's science instruments needs to stay cold because it will be seeking heat signals from very distant objects, NASA explains. That side is expected to operate at about 225 degrees below zero Celsius. The hot side, which NASA says is designed to operate at about 85 degrees Celsius, holds the telescope's solar power system and communications and other equipment. The sun shield successfully opened about a week and a half after James Webb launched. A few days later, the observatory's nearly 7-meter mirror was deployed. The mirror, a collection of 18 different pieces, still needs to be perfectly aligned before the telescope can operate. NASA expects that process to take about 3 months. James Webb is designed to detect infrared waves, a kind of electromagnetic energy that cannot be seen with the human eye. The telescope's instruments were built to find infrared waves through gas and dust in an effort to observe distant objects. The infrared detection system and the telescope's scientific instruments will need to get cold enough to perform effectively. If all goes well, NASA says it expects James Webb to produce its first early release observations sometime in June. NASA officials leading the project have been pleased with how things have progressed so far. Webb is officially on station, observatory manager Keith Parrish told reporters. He said the telescope's orbital arrival came after a remarkable 30 days in space. James Webb is considered NASA's new generation telescope after the Hubble and Spitzer Space Telescopes. Hubble was launched more than 30 years ago, and Spitzer was deployed in 2003. Both of those telescopes led to numerous discoveries and provided more detailed, colorful space images than ever before. But the new telescope aims to help scientists learn about all periods of the universe's history dating back to just after the Big Bang event, about 13.8 billion years ago. It is also designed to study exoplanets, planets that orbit stars other than the Sun. We're one step closer to uncovering the mysteries of the universe, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said in a statement. And I can't wait to see Webb's first new views of the universe this summer, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On November 11th, 1918, a truce was signed ending the hostilities of World War I. The Central Powers, led by Germany, had lost. The Allies, led by Britain, France, and the United States, had won. The war lasted 4 years. It took the lives of 10 million people. It left much of Europe in ruins. It was described as the war to end all wars. Barbara Klein and Doug Johnson tell about President Woodrow Wilson and his part in events after the war.
The immediate task was to seek agreement on terms of a peace treaty. The Allies were filled with bitter anger. They demanded a treaty that would punish Germany severely. They wanted to make Germany weak by destroying its military and industry. And they wanted to ruin Germany's economy by making it pay all war damages. Germany, they said, must never go to war again. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States did not agree completely with the other allies. He wanted a peace treaty based on justice, not bitterness. He believed that would produce a lasting peace. President Wilson had led negotiations for a truce to end the hostilities of World War I. Now, he hoped to play a major part in negotiations for a peace treaty. To be effective, he needed the full support of the American people.
Americans had supported Wilson's policies through most of the war. They had accepted what was necessary to win. This meant higher taxes and shortages of goods. At the time, Americans seemed to forget party politics. Democrats and Republicans worked together. All that changed when it became clear the war was ending. Congressional elections were to be held in November 1918. President Wilson was a Democrat. He feared that Republicans might gain a majority of seats in Congress. If they did, his negotiating powers at a peace conference in Europe would be weakened. Wilson told the nation, "The return of a Republican majority to either House of Congress would be seen by foreign leaders as a rejection of my leadership."
Republicans protested. They charged that Wilson's appeal to voters was an insult to every Republican. One party leader said, "This is not the president's private war." The Republican campaign succeeded. The party won control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The congressional elections were a defeat for President Wilson, but he did not let the situation interfere with his plans for a peace conference. He and the other Allied leaders agreed to meet in Paris in January 1919.
In the weeks before the conference, Wilson chose members of his negotiating team. Everyone expected him to include one or more senators. After all, the Senate would vote to approve or reject the final peace treaty. Wilson refused. Instead, he chose several close advisers to go with him to Paris. Today, American history experts say Wilson's decision was a mistake. Failure to put senators on the negotiating team, they say, cost him valuable support later on. In early December, President Wilson sailed to France. The voyage across the Atlantic Ocean lasted 9 days. He arrived at the port of Brest on December 13th. Wilson felt very happy. 13, he said, was his lucky number.
French citizens stood along the railroad that carried him from Brest to Paris. They cheered as his train passed. In Paris, cannons were fired to announce his arrival, and a huge crowd welcomed him there. The people shouted his name over and over again, "Wilson, Wilson, Wilson." The noise sounded like thunder. French Premier Georges Clemenceau commented on the event. He said, "I do not think there has been anything like it in the history of the world." People cheered President Wilson partly to thank America for sending its troops to help fight against Germany. But many French citizens and other Europeans also shared Wilson's desire to establish a new world of peace. They listened with hope as he made an emotional speech about a world in which everyone would reject hatred, a world in which everyone would join together to end war forever.
More than 25 nations that helped win the war sent representatives to the peace conference in Paris. All took part in the negotiations. However, the important decisions were made by the so-called Big Four: Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, Premier Vittorio Orlando of Italy, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. Wilson hoped the other Allied leaders would accept his plan for a new international organization. The organization would be called the League of Nations. Wilson believed the League could prevent future wars by deciding fair settlements of disputes between nations. He believed it would be the world's only hope for a lasting peace.
Most of the other representatives did not have Wilson's faith in the power of peace. Yet they supported his plan for the League of Nations. However, they considered it less important than completing a peace treaty with Germany, and they did not want to spend much time talking about it. They feared that negotiations on the League might delay the treaty and the rebuilding of Europe. Wilson was firm. He demanded that the peace treaty also establish the League. So he led a group at the conference that wrote a plan for the operation of the League. He gave the plan to the European leaders to consider. Then he returned to the United States for a brief visit.
President Wilson soon learned that opposition to the League of Nations existed on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Many Americans opposed it strongly. Some Republican senators began criticizing it even before Wilson's ship reached the port of Boston. The senators said the plan failed to recognize America's long-term interests. They said it would take away too many powers from national governments. 37 senators signed a resolution saying the United States should reject the plan for the League of Nations. That was more than the number of votes needed to defeat a peace treaty to which Wilson hoped the League plan would be linked.
The Senate resolution hurt Wilson politically. It was a sign to the rest of the world that he did not have the full support of his people. But he returned to Paris anyway. He got more bad news when he arrived. Wilson's top advisor at the Paris Peace Conference was Colonel Edward House. Colonel House had continued negotiations while Wilson was back in the United States. House agreed with Wilson on most issues. Unlike Wilson, however, he believed the Allies' most urgent need was to reach agreement on a peace treaty with Germany. To do this, House was willing to make many more compromises than Wilson on details for the League of Nations.
Wilson was furious when he learned what House had done. He said, "Colonel House has given away everything I had won before I left Paris. He has compromised until nothing remains. Now I have to start all over again. This time it will be more difficult." For Woodrow Wilson, the most difficult negotiations still lay ahead.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.